All thy works proclaim thee. The book of God's works. Image of thy majesty, we are imagers and mirrors of God's love for the world. God's calling to us, music, art, the fruitful garden, all the labor of our days. What we have done adversely to creation and our consciences are all grim reminders. Yet God's revealed grace and mercy claim our praise, and all creation praises God. We are saved to magnify God's goodness. We are saved to fulfill God's purposes in our words and in the acts, in our lives, in our landscapes, in God's garden, in oikomene. In this conclusion of our wonderful time together, I'm going to give you some insight into academic vocation through a topic Terry Morrison assigned to me at Christmas time in 2004. We were having a faculty breakfast, as he organizes regularly, and he did something different at this time. He didn't give me the option of what I was to speak on. He told me what the topic was. And the topic was how I learned to be busy, productive, and happy. Time management for the Christian academic. Does that sound like a Terry title? Well, if I began right away to tell you what I said at that particular breakfast, I would miss some very important points. And so I have a prelude. I had an epilogue yesterday. Today I have a prelude. And the prelude is this. I would like to say a few things before I really begin, because otherwise I would forget. As for the university, give your very best to the university. Be an exemplary chair of one university-level committee. Recruit Christian students to your university from evangelical colleges. Work within your university to get outreach activities recognized as part of our professional responsibilities. Work to keep scientia, ethics, and praxis coherently interactive within the university. Work to keep the university operating within the fullness of creation's economy. As for the wider world, bring the good news far and wide. Prepare clear written pieces for the press and be proactive in informing writers and reporters of what is important and what needs to be done. Be strategic in generating interest in the press and in the church to important things that otherwise would be neglected. Serve on a local government committee or council. Invite all your neighbors over to your house at least once a year. Work to keep your community and the wider world operating within the fullness of creation's economy. As for yourself and your family, empty the garbage, pet the cat, feed the fish, mow the lawn, change the light bulbs, scatter the prairie seeds, use the vacuum cleaner, monitor your own health and physiology, organize the books around the house, check the internet to learn more about metabolic syndrome, prune the trees, clear the top of your workbench, get a haircut, cut your toenails. Professors have holes in their socks a lot. It's because this is the lowest priority. And my rule to my colleagues is every day, pick something of the very lowest priority and do it. That's helpful. because then you can live better with your wife. Oil the hinges. Process the contents of waste baskets. Get a medical checkup. Clean the garage. Work with your spouse to make your house and home eminently livable and joyful. Get your teeth cleaned at the dentist. Read both books personally and with your family. Put the Whistler tea kettle on the stove at low heat and put an inspiring audio CD into the disk drive. Work to do everything within the fullness of creation's economy and to the glory of the author of both books. And now with that covered, I can begin. Good morning. It's great to begin the day with good food, good fellowship, and good colleagues. About a year and a half ago, Terry asked me to do this, and he simply assigned it. And I trusted his wisdom and agreed to do it. And so his request first challenged me to ask, am I really that productive? To answer that question, I had to take a look at myself and what I had accomplished over the course of a year, a decade. And what I found was that Terry had helped me discover that I am, in fact, productive, as well as busy and happy. But the funny thing about this discovery was that this was news to me. I never thought of myself as being productive. It was simply a byproduct of something else. His request also challenged me to ask, why me? Why would he ask me? There are lots of academics, including Christian academics, that are productive and more productive than I am, and some of these are here in this room. They are so exemplary, in fact, that I often hold them up as examples and models to my graduate students. So who am I to say anything on this topic to my highly productive colleagues? Moreover, there are so many ways to be productive that my approach to productivity clearly is not the only way. There is no doubt that there are other ways that have greater integrity and are, in fact, more productive. So who am I to speak on this topic? I'll proceed, however, by reporting to you some of the results of a study I conducted on my own life and performance. That's one nice thing about being an academic, is you know how to study and do research, and it's not a bad idea, actually, to turn around and look at yourself and ask, who are you? And are you doing it? Are you doing it right? Are you living your life as a psalm to the Lord? An important product of my two-week self-study was a list of words and phrases that I wrote over the course of a day. Words and phrases I believe somehow to be related to my topic of investigation, myself. I jotted these down as I went to church, participated in the service, listened to the sermon, drove home with my good wife Ruth, she was driving, and enjoyed some Sabbath rest. I guess I did not consider this work, since I generally keep Sunday as a day of rest, a day in which, to use the rabbinical dictum, I create nothing, destroy nothing, and enjoy the fruits of God's good creation. I transcribed these words and phrases into my computer and then organized and reorganized them, gathering them under various topics and headings and moving the most important items to the top of the organized list. And then, this is going to repeat something you've heard before from me, a few days later, I hesitantly told Ruth what Terry had asked me to do. Very much to my surprise, she immediately volunteered the answer to the question Terry had asked in his assigned title. More remarkable, it was the fact that it was identical to the one that I had on the top of my list. It's passion, said Ruth. My wife and I had agreed instantly. So as Terry helped me to learn that I was productive, Ruth helped me to see that the root of my productivity was passion. So far, so good. But there I was, benefiting personally from Terry's assignment, and now I must find a way to make this beneficial to you. One way to begin is to dissect the assigned title. Now, that's what I often do when I don't know what I'm doing, is I take the assigned title, and since I've taught comparative anatomy, amongst many other courses, one of the things that I do is, you know, just dissect things from each other and then see if I can put them back together again. And so here's the title, How I Learned to Be Busy, Productive, and Happy, Time Management for the Christian Academics. So this means that I've learned to be busy, productive, and happy. That was point one. Two, that I should tell you how I learned this. That's point two. And three, and this means that I should say something about being busy, being productive, and being happy. Very illuminating, isn't it? My dad said to me in my youth, do what you love to do, then you'll do it very well, and someone will eventually pay you for it. This was his rendition of Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of God. Of course, if you are living your life for Jesus, and then you do what you love to do, and then you do it very well, you will be following the gifts that God has given you. And it is remarkable that in our day and age, someone will eventually pay you for it. I remember the first time I was teaching at the University of Michigan's Dearborn campus, and I was on my very first field trip with my students, and I was just about ready to say something about a bird in a tree, and I stopped, and I couldn't speak. And then I had to explain to my students why I had become speechless. And I lowered my hand and I said, I'm sorry. I said, you know, I just had to stop because I was overcome by this thought. I'm getting paid for this. In saying this to me, my dad also professed in nonverbal ways the things he did along these same lines. And, of course, I told you yesterday that part of that was shown in just his singing of This Is My Savior. I know that what I have to say about this now, the next things I'm going to say, are going to strike you as being very odd, but now you kind of expect it because, well, you've heard some already. I should say, you'll see it unfolding here, but I should say this morning, you know, you're preparing, you wonder if it's going to work, and then you think, I think it's going to work, and you're at the computer, and it's pretty intense, and Ruth delivers some coffee, and I sip a little, and it's really intense, and then you think, now what should I really be doing in life? And of course the answer is spelling the daisies. So in the midst of all this, Ruth had left at that point and had released the red-bellied snake, or maybe did it a little later, I walked out to the northern reach of Lake Huron, and walked along the beach a little bit, and I saw my coreopsis growing there again, and there it was, all facing the sun. And I wondered, you know, yesterday and the day before, why does Coreopsis always look at the sun? I made a major discovery this morning. I did. It's a scientific discovery. I don't think it's ever appeared in the literature, and it's very, very important. I saw a monarch butterfly flying around, and I tracked it with my eyes, and it came down to a Coreopsis flower, unfurled its great proboscis. They hold it up as a coiled drinking straw beneath their chin, and they roll it way out, and they stick it into individual little flowers. Coreopsis really has, it's really an inflorescence made up of many flowers, and the flowers in the center are tube flowers, and the flowers on the outside are strap flowers with one big fused petal. That's the structure of these flowers. And this monarch unfurled this proboscis, stuck it in, and then he came up like this, and I saw there was another monarch this far away, and they both flew up together. They flew around like this, and then they both came down to Coreopsis flowers again. And the thing that I noticed was absolutely astounding. There was one Coreopsis flower, for some unknown reason to me, was not facing the sun. Maybe it didn't have energy or inspiration or something or other, but it was looking to the south. And one of these butterflies landed on it and quickly moved to one that was facing the sun. And then as it sipped the sweet nectar, it spread out its wings. And the other one next to it, as it was sipping nectar, was spreading out its wings. These butterflies in early morn had low body temperatures, and they had to get their body temperatures up, and the Coreopsis was looking at the sun in such a way that when you feed, you can maximize your surface exposure to the sun's rays. It's absolutely wonderful. And so then later I saw a tiger swallowtail come in and did the same thing. So Coreopsis says, come, drink the sweet nectar, and I will orient the nectar-bearing flowers at such an angle that you can maximize your solar gain. Suppose they have to minimize their solar gain. I saw that too this morning, because one of these butterflies that went from flower to flower obviously got so warm that it finally came into a flower and it collapsed its wings totally. So now it was just this little thin line from the viewpoint of the sun, regulating its body temperature by the good graces of Coreopsis, who had the good sense of keeping turning to the sun by the grace of God. Isn't that lovely? Well, every morning you can make discoveries like that. How is my passion expressed? You just saw it. Does it seem odd that I simply cannot wait to get back to my computer, to the library, to my books, to my terrarium of carnivorous plants, to my marsh, to my desert study site, to the high mountain plants in my rock garden, to the prairie remnant, with such passion that I often feel like a wound-up jack-in-the-box, ready to pounce upon my research? Just where I had left off, or just where I felt inspired to take a fresh new look? Does it seem odd, an odd thing, that when I discover something new to me or new to all of us, that my heart leaps in my chest with such a thrill that I feel like singing, running, praising, psalming? Does it seem an odd thing that finding something new that I cannot help but tell others what I have found, enlisting them into the pleasure of investigation and discovery? Does it seem an odd thing that I cannot wait to get into the lecture hall to interact with my dear students, and that I am sad at every lecture's end? Does it seem an odd thing that I am sad at day's end, when my eyes no longer will stay open as they, in a drying and raw state, strive to maintain the connection between me and the text that is flowing on my computer screen? For me, of course, these are not odd things. Quite the contrary, they are the things that express and fuel my passion. But now back to the topic that Terry had assigned me that Christmas time. There's something very nice about doing this assignment. It provides the pause that allows me to take a look. One thing I find and know is that being busy, productive, and happy are byproducts of passion. But how did I learn the passion? Here's the answer, I believe. One, by the care and keeping of animals in my backyard zoo and basement lab room from my early childhood and on into grade school, high school, and college. That's one. This was accompanied by the love, tolerance, and encouragement of my mom, who unceasingly cleaned up after my parakeets in the dining room and the cockatiel in the kitchen, and unflinchingly did her wash next to the cages that contained the animals that had to be brought inside over the winter, snakes and lizards, with the love, tolerance, and encouragement of my dad, who nightly conversed with me about my discoveries made during the day, who provided the example of craftsmanship that I attempted to reflect in my own work, and whose singing psalms and hymns during the course of his work was a continuing inspiration. Two, by doing all of this caring, keeping, and study of creatures in my backyard, with family and neighbors being intrigued with what I was caring for, what I was keeping, and what I was discovering. Everyone, it seemed, was interested in what I was doing, and visits by playmates and neighbors were frequent, each visit providing the opportunity to tell, to teach, and to learn. Three, by discussing the findings of the day with my father nearly every evening, my dad and I would sit at the kitchen table, pour out some ginger ale or other soda, and he would have me tell my discoveries of the day in classroom and lab, in the backyard zoo, basement aquaria, and aviary. What I believe is this: discoveries can be the result of passionate love and work with the many creatures we can observe, study, care for, and keep. Discoveries can and will generate wonder and delight, making it necessary that they are shared with others, and this providing the conditions for learning and effective teaching. Sharing of discoveries must be effective in the sense that the truth, detail, and nature of the discovery simply must be conveyed successfully to fellow children, to youth, to adults around you, to fellow adults as we grow up. Teaching discoveries effectively with passion, truth, and detail lead to questions and ideas that inspire further discovery. All of this taken together means that there is an inspiring reciprocity. Discovery leads to telling and effective teaching. Telling and effective teaching leads to excitement in other individuals and the wider community, and this excitement spurs one on to discovery. There is something absolutely wonderful about finding out new things about the creatures around us. It is not only that there are people to tell and people who respond, there are the creatures themselves with which and with whom you interact, some oblivious, some responding reflexively, some responding reciprocally. Communion is not too strong of a word here. Applied to the human community and applied to the creatures being studied, nurtured, and maintained, discovery, awe, and wonder derive from communion with the community of living things, the oikoumene, that join us in the orbit of our knowledge and life. When Terry gave me this assignment, I had, in October of that year, been asked to do what many faculty members are asked to do. We are asked to come before a group of graduate students in the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin and convey to them thoughts that would be helpful to them in their graduate career and in their professional career. And so what I found myself doing is spinning out story after story after story, and then I would say, this leads number one to, and I was surprised at that. And Number two, and by the time I was finished, I had 10 of them, and I didn't know what these were. They just kind of came off the top of my head. Really, they didn't. You know, it was kind of the byproduct of what I was saying, and I didn't know what those 10 were. So afterwards, I wrote a note to the coordinator of this seminar and said, could you convey the points I made? In fact, what he had said is, these points were really well taken by the students, and it was so exciting to everybody. Could you give them to us? And so I wrote him back saying, could you give them back to me? Because I don't know what they were. And so Jim Miller wrote me, and he gave me these points, and one was very doubtful, and I had checked with other students to find out what I had said. That's why I'm glad this session is being taped, because I'll finally find out what I say. So I spun out these stories as they were becoming acquainted with university life and wove these into their lives of teaching and research and professional expectations as professors. While I had not planned to do this, here are the 10 points. The students called them pointers. I found that kind of interesting. And together they illustrate the passion from which come from productivity and joy. Here they are. One, plunge in. I talk quite a bit to Christian College faculty members, and they say, I have to do research, you know. Like, you know, our new dean says we have to do research, and I'm a teacher. And I look at them and say, you know, where's your passion? I mean, did you like what you did for your PhD dissertation? No, I hated it. I say, well, what in life do you love? You know, that's what you should do your research on. Or maybe, like Laura Miller told me, the person who went on to become the mayor of Houston, she said, discover where your outrage is. That will generate passion, too. Plunge in, meaning that you move immediately into your subject, fully, enthusiastically, with great commitment. Don't start with the introduction. You'll never get anywhere. Write the introduction only when you have something to introduce. Inspire, number two, meaning that you engage others in the excitement of your quest and that you breathe into your work vibrancy and vigorous life. Three, profess. Meaning that you go beyond training and instructing in the things you discover to professing who you are, why you are doing your work, and why you are so deeply committed to it. And profess with empathy and compassion. See your own sons and daughters, parents, brothers and sisters in the eyes and faces of your students. Because if you express your passion without compassion, it can come across really like a lead brick. Irrelevant, coming from, you know, someone who's crazy. In fact, sometimes people say in my, I had one this semester, he said, Cal DeWitt is crazy, and he's the best professor I've ever had. They go together. Celebrate, number four, meaning that the discoveries you make from the literature, from the creatures you study, be acknowledged with exclamation, announcement, and joy. Ruth is bothered by this because I sometimes come home and say, we have to celebrate. And Ruth will say, let's take a rain check on that. You cannot take a rain check on celebration when you've just made a brilliant discovery. And, of course, she knows that. And so, yes, we go out and celebrate. And then at night we get heartburn and stuff because we ate too much steak or something or other. And then Ruth says to me, we should never eat that late again. And I agree and so on. But, of course, when you make a discovery, you have to celebrate, and you have to select the way you're going to do it. And be careful, because sometimes your celebration can just do you in. And you'll cease to be productive for a while. Number five, be classic. Meaning that at least some investigations that you do are so thorough, so comprehensive, and so original that the published work has a high probability of being recognized as a classic contribution to your field or to the field of knowledge. That is so fun. You know, instead of just producing a paper, say, okay, here are the different things I'm doing. Right there is a place I think I can produce classic work. One of the ways I get to find those is because there's no one else there. You know, if there's a horde of scientists or philosophers or historians around this subject, that's likely not going to be an area that you're going to develop classic work. But every once in a while, I find myself working in an area, and you look around, there's no literature here, or very few, or very little, and it's way out of date, and there's no one there now, and it's passe stuff, and yet it's extremely important, like a butterfly feeding on a coreopsis. I mean, for plant-animal interactions, isn't that pretty exciting? You know, plants and animals do strongly interact, but here is a very, very interesting question. What happens if amongst the flowers out there, these coreopsis flowers, a whole bunch of them decide to turn opposite from the sun? Tough luck for them. They don't get pollinated. And it's really interesting. I was laying on my tummy on the top of Earth Hall at Osavo Institute, a building I designed as an earth-sheltered laboratory and office building. And we moved 12 inches of subsoil and 3 inches of topsoil to the side, built the building into the ground, and then covered the roof with a membrane, a rubber membrane and other things, and put the soil back on the roof, and there the forest came back. Max Terman, an ecologist who teaches at Osavo, studied this site as a clearing and saw no difference statistically between this and any other forest clearing in its use by birds. And so I was up there on my tummy studying birds. It's a great place to study birds. And there was a cedar waxwing up there eating the wild strawberries. And I watched it. It came sometimes within a couple of feet of my face. And I've learned to be very quiet for very, very long periods of time. Sometimes I don't even move my eyeballs. You know, I cultivate my peripheral vision. But most of the times I do move my eyeballs. Slowly. Because you don't want to give any cue to the animals around you. They're especially sensitive to eyes, as you probably know. That's why there are eye spots on caterpillars and butterflies and so forth. And so here comes the cedar waxwing. He comes to a pretty big strawberry, and he bypasses it. He comes to a little strawberry. He bypasses it. He comes to a green strawberry. He bypasses it. Aha, here's a red strawberry, and it's exactly one mouthful. He eats it. He does that time and time and time again, and then he flies off and he defecates. And he defecates. Its defecation has a black end and a white end. The white end is uric acid, and the black end is the fecal matter. And the uric acid is a nitrogen fertilizer, and the fecal matter is the organic material. So inside are the seeds. Birds are playing back and forth with strawberries and other fruits. Fruits produce cathartics. You've probably noticed that, especially if you eat a lot of fruit. And God's design here is that these seeds not be digested, but they go right on through and get deposited with fertilizer. And so these cedar waxwings are defecating all over the forest. And guess what? Almost all the strawberries of the forest are the right size for cedar waxwing bills, because that's the only seeds they plant. And why are our strawberries so big and tasteless? because we have big eyes and big mouths. And we buy before we think. And then we eat it and say, isn't this marvelous? It's not very sweet. Let's dip it in chocolate. Be classic means pick the subject, pick a topic where you can do your very best. And don't be in a hurry, but do the very best so that 50 years later, there it is in lights. It may have been minor, but it's a classic. Six, dig deeply, meaning that the subject in reality and its representation in the literature be researched as thoroughly as possible, using all the means available for its discovery. That's why the OED is always coming in my work, because I always look up the meanings of every word of that's being applied to the processes, the objects of my study. But, of course, it connects with JSTOR, J-S-T-O-R, which is a tremendous research tool available on the web, which allows you to do word searches of the entire subset of professional journals. That's why the Gutenberg project is so great, because you can download the text digitally of all sorts of classic works and other sources too. So I've downloaded, as I said before, the complete works of Charles Darwin. Then you do a word search. You don't have to be a scholar on Darwin to discover that he didn't like Darwinism. All you have to do is do a word search. He's got one paragraph in all of his volumes that describes this, and you can find it in about 10 minutes. It's amazing. JSTOR, J-S-T-O-R. And you also discover things that no one else has ever discovered. I put in the word blue clay. I didn't know for sure whether that word was being used, but when I dig deep beneath my marsh, unfolding and interpreting the layers of peat that are laid down each year, I live on a history book of 10,000 pages of Earth's history, all layers of peat, and there's pollen in every layer telling what kind of trees and shrubs and flowers there were around. And there's volcanic ash from all the big volcanic eruptions in all these layers, so much so that I found the ash layer from the eruption of Mount Mazama that created Crater Lake, for example. It's a tremendous history book sitting there. And at the bottom of the history book is this layer of blue clay. It's everywhere. Under marshes, big marshes. And I wondered, how does it get there? And I thought of glacier milk. Ruth and I were at the Athabasca Glacier. We went to Glacier National Park, but at Athabasca Glacier in the Columbian ice fields, where we have not only a continental divide between two watersheds, but three, the Arctic Ocean, Pacific and Atlantic. There are these great big glaciers, and coming out from the glaciers are these streams that look like they're milk. And the suspended material in there is like a talcum powder, and it's kept in suspension by Brownian movement. These particles are so close in size to water molecules, they're kept up in the water for long, long periods of time. You'll see these every once in a while in borrow pits when an expressway or roadway is being built. When you dig a ditch around here or a pit to get fill material, you get a color like Lake Louise. And that is a resuspension of the glacial flour. My hypothesis was that blue clay is a precipitation, ultimately, of glacial flour. I think it is. But to test that, I put into JSTOR blue clay, not knowing. I just called it that because it's blue. And it came up all over the place. And I was able to put together a document on blue clay that would have been impossible to put together without JSTOR, because it crosses all the literature. Why is it blue? just incidentally, this is a parenthesis within parenthesis. It's blue because it's reduced iron. And if you put it in, if you form a pot and fire it, it goes orange. This is for Cam's benefit. And Chicago bricks are made out of this. That's why they're orange. And the clay that was dug for them is blue or blue-gray. Dig deeply. And what I do in my digging deeply is I dig through 10,000 years of peat, reading the pages, as Leopold says, the sodden pages of its own history, down to the blue clay, and read the literature deeply. 7, be diligent and persistent, even in adversity, meaning that obstacles and hurdles that get in the way must be overcome by thought, persistence, diligence, persistence, and wisdom. Be ethical and ask what ought to be. That's number 8. Meaning that what is discovered should be placed in the broad context, not only of how the world works, but in the context of ethical integrity. 9, put work into practice. Meaning that what is discovered should be put into practice or should be so presented that others will put it into practice. I do a lot of work here to make sure that what we have learned is actually put into practice. And I've done that in part by becoming the chair or the mayor of my town in the mid-1970s and transforming the town into a stewardship community. We now are listed on a couple of websites, as a national example of a sustainable community, 34 and a half square miles of land, because what we did is we put into place a stewardship plan, a land stewardship plan, that flows out of my study of the scriptures and my study of the environment, the two books. And finally, always be on vocation. A Mennonite farmer friend and his 16-year-old son came to work for us at Pacific Rim a couple of summers ago to celebrate the son's 16th birthday, Isaac's 16th birthday. And after Greg had seen me working so diligently for many days, he said, "Cal, do you ever take a vacation?" And I said, "Greg, I'm always on vocation, and it's lovely." Don't vacate your vocation. Vocate your vacation. That's what you're doing here. Turn it into a calling. So the subtitle that Terry gave to me was Time Management for the Christian Academic. So what about time management? What can I say? Let most of the timing of when and where your product will be produced come as a byproduct of passion. That's easy to say. But boy, if you've got passion for what you're doing. Ruth knows it well. I can go to bed at 3 and get up at 4:30. I can go for 3 weeks on end with 4 hours sleep. Not because I'm not tired. It's just because I'm so driven by my love of what I'm doing, I cannot wait to get at it. And then, what am I doing here? I'm sleeping so well and so long. Because this is pretty easy. It still is hard, but it's pretty easy because I brought my whole computer with and I've got all my files with me. It's in there somewhere and I can pull out this stuff. When you're working in an unknown area where no one knows yet and you're trying to produce original observations and so on, that can be really tough. And if you're really on to something and it's starting to unfold, you just have to. You have to stay with it. It's kind of like, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Einstein says to the Lord as he's working, "Lord, give me a push." He speaks in German. He refers to God as der Herrgott. And he says, "Give me a push. You know, Lord, that there's no one else thinking like this. And I'm not thinking far enough,
And if I don't get the push from you, this might not be discovered for another decade or several decades or maybe a few centuries. Please, one push. And I read quite a bit of Einstein because he really communes with the Creator. And
it's so interesting. You know, it's interesting to ask, how in the wide world did he ever come up with the speed of light as a constant,
which of course didn't work if you multiply it times mass to get energy, and then he decided to square it. So, yes, the square of the speed of light is a constant, definitely a constant. And if you multiply that times mass, you'll get the energy produced from the mass conversion to energy. Could you just come up with that? What he did is he believed, and he believed in, it's very easy for an evangelical to say, he believed in a different God than we did, or than we do. But I'm not so sure about that. He communed with God differently. He was more like this Old Testament prophet saying, God, give me the gift. but he is tussling with God. And I often, when I'm doing my study, I mean, I try to always be in prayer. You know, prayer is a continuous thing. It's like psalming is a continuous thing. And every once in a while, it reaches some sort of crescendo. I played the trombone, and a crescendo is marked like that. You know, and it means get louder and louder and louder. And you get to the point where saying, I'm almost there. Please, please, please. You know, please, don't the phone ring. of course, sometimes that comes late in the night, early in the morning, with no disturbance and so forth. But by saying this, I don't mean that care should not be taken to accomplish the work with timeliness or without discipline. Here are a few things of many that I've found to be important that relate to time management and productivity. One, create and nurture an inspiring environment within which to be productive with joy. Ruth knows I do this. I mean, my study is like a cockpit in the spaceship called Oikoumene, with windows looking out on Oikoumene, with J.S. Bach melodies coming in, every one of which is concluded with the words, Soli Deo Gloria. And the fugue is playing, and I'm jibing with this fugue. Create and nurture an inspiring environment within which to be productive with joy. Two, make sure that discovery and development continues to produce something every day. Today it was the monarch and Coreopsis and their interrelationships for me. Maybe it'll be something more. Yesterday it was for Ruth and me, the discovery of Orthocercus, which means straight horn, which is, we discovered this, not an original discovery, a 28-inch long shell of this cephalopod on the Elvar on Drummond Island yesterday evening. So it would make the whole animal maybe this long, and Ruth took a soft pencil and paper, and we did a rubbing of it. She can show it to you. Make sure that discovery and development continues to produce something every day. Three, pay attention to good craftsmanship. Work to get things in right relationship. You know, oddly, I suppose it might seem, I get this from my father because he was a painter and decorator with just superb craftsmanship. And craftsmanship is like that. you're always doing things as well as you possibly can.
Four, resist diversion and interruption of work and idea development. Keep on the ideas development track. So at Asabol, when I was really on one of these tracks, I said to my son Gary when he was about this high, when you have a need, run into my office. I will do anything I need to do, but I'll have to stay in the office. And one time he came running in the office with a fishing pole and a fish flopping on the hook, and he said, "Dad, I can't get it off. Can you do it?" And I took the fish off the hook, and I continued to be productive. It doesn't mean I didn't go fishing with the son, with my son or daughters. I did. But resist diversion and interruption of work and idea development. Organize everything continuously. I get, as I'm writing, as I'm discovering, I get myself into a parenthesis. And then I get into a parenthesis within the parenthesis, and I'm writing about something about which is not my theme because I drifted into that. It's exciting. So I block move that stuff into a new file and block move that into a new file and then come back and organize it so I can find it again. Ruth chuckled a little bit this morning because I was trying to find this material, these 10 points, and I called up the file where it's supposed to be, and it wasn't there. But there was a file that looked like it should be the file, and I called it up, and it said, this file is under one main, DeWitt, subfile, belief, a personal belief, and then a file under that called time management. And I thought it would be better to have this under my personal beliefs than under a paper, but I had a note on how I could find it. Really interesting, because I knew I'd come into this kind of crisis otherwise. Organize everything continuously. Order and reorder things as you work to get everything into its right place. The farmer across the road said to me once, Russ Clemens, a job is never finished until the tools are all returned to the right place. That's why I really have to get down and clean up my workbench. It's awful. Six, and keep the 10 pointers that I've given you above constantly in mind, all together. With these six points as a basis for time and idea management, also do the following. And you'll see that even, I was worried about finishing the material today. That's why I'm reading quite a bit. But I usually don't read anything because of point seven. Point seven, maintain eye contact with the people with whom you are discussing or lecturing. Always. This will give you the feedback necessary to restate and paraphrase what you have just said in order to achieve looks of understanding in the eyes and postures of the people with whom you are communicating. This morning, I particularly appreciate John Dahl. I appreciate Cam Anderson. I could name about four or five people that have nodded at just the right places, or shifted posture at just the right places. It's so cool. I do that with every one of my students. If I have one of my students that is off on another subject in his head, I'll hook him. And it won't be long before he'll be with the rest of us. So even though Dan is sitting way in the corner back there, he's engaged, but Dan is one of the first people I'll look at because he might be there to avoid eye contact. So I really make sure I contact my eyes with Dan and his wife right next to him. This eye contact also provides the benefit of finding new and often better ways to express your work. Like, people say, I'm funny. I don't intend to be funny. But what happens is when people laugh, I try it again, and they laugh again. And then someone says, where'd you learn this humor? And I say, from you. Because I can't be funny. It's a byproduct of interaction with people. It also provides new insights into the work you are doing and new ways to express it in writing. 8, go beyond seeking and teaching knowledge to seeking and teaching understanding. Fantastic. One of the things my students often will give in their final evaluations of the course is they not only gain knowledge and they not only gain understanding, but they gain wisdom in this class. That's the sequence. What this means is that you should show how your work coheres with the rest of knowledge, with the life and dynamics of the rest of the world, in working to help others and yourself gain understanding. Be consciously rhetorical. Like, I save goodies in a little package, and you wonder, when is it going to break out? Like, this farmer let his land rest every 2 years, and I start talking about the Sabbath and every 7 years. Never mention anything about the 2 years until the end of my presentation and say, oh, yeah, by the way, 2 years. Yeah, it was just bugging you. It's a rhetorical technique to keep you a little bit bothered and expectant. Unfold your talk and discussions in ways that bring your listeners, readers with you and to conclusions they might not otherwise accept. 9, take and make time to write following your times of observation, even if it's totally exhausting. I was in the swamps of Sumatra. I was on a journey by boat of 300 miles. There were 13 species of malaria and mosquitoes. And we had come to a point where we had to stop for the evening at a stilt house in the swamp with grass thatch roof, no screens. And I was absolutely exhausted. My bowels were absolutely full, and there was no place to go, except there was a hole at a little dock that was out into the water, and everyone could see what was coming through the hole. I decided not to do it. And I also had a really bad headache. And we lit these wicks to scare away the mosquitoes. Malaria mosquitoes. And everyone went to sleep. We had no mosquito netting. I had a candle. I lit my candle, and I wrote my journal. And it was a painful writing. Absolutely painful. Take and make time to write following even exhausting times of observation, speaking, and discussing. Capture your thoughts and observations soon or immediately after they have come to you, while you still have them fresh in mind. For example, right after a lecture you may have given, look over your notes, rearrange, edit them to reflect what you actually said. 10, that's the last one. Use your speaking and discussion, including your after-lecture edited notes, as a primer to your writing. And as this talk today has a prelude, it also has a postlude. I'm tuning with Shirley on this, of course. There are many other things that are related to the purpose of this talk, and this is my postlude. Of these, here are some. Enjoy your life, spouse, and family, and make it possible for them to enjoy you. No little task. Monitor and seek contentment, both for you and members of your family. Give your entire Saturday and Sunday to your family and household while the children are still in the nest. Go to church each Sunday with your spouse and children. Take Sunday afternoon adventure rides with your family, including picnicking or eating at interesting places. Take weekly hikes with your family.
Make a weekly luncheon appointment with your spouse during the day through your office secretary. My secretary would say, oh, Dr. DeWitt has a two-hour appointment on next Monday. Oh, well, then I can't see him. That's right. And that's when Ruth and I would go to lunch, right during the intensity of the academic week. Attend your children's school programs and parent-teacher meetings. Have all breakfasts and supper times and all three meals on Saturdays and Sundays with your family, with singing and prayer at each. Make the Sunday noon meal special, including reading of Scripture at the table. Sing together as much as possible. Help each member to learn to play a musical instrument. Enjoy Friday evenings out with your spouse. Go grocery shopping, painful as it might be, about once a month with your spouse. I bug Ruth because I read all the labels. Take care of your own person, including your teeth, health, and appearance. Deal with everyone with compassion and empathy. Apply Christian values to all disciplines and walks of life. Know what you believe about yourself, the world, and God. Seek the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Practice hospitality and availability. Be gracious and diplomatic. Practice discipline. Acknowledge God's grace always. And finally, challenge injustice. Challenge neglectful scholarship. Challenge obscurant scholarship. Challenge and resist dumbing down things in your world of work and living. Promote four-part harmony and its equivalents in all aspects of life and community. Serve with grace, but be unswerving in serving. Be a student always. Thank you for your good responses. We will have 2 hours of discussion for any of you who are interested this afternoon at 2 o'clock. It's a delight for me to have had the opportunity to pull these things together. I thank Terry particularly for this opportunity, for not only this opportunity, but for priming me many other times. I thank John Dahl and Cam Anderson as colleagues in Madison, who from time to time over the years have inspired me and encouraged me in my work. And I also thank all of you as professors and spouses of professors for the kind of commitment that all of us have and all of you show to seeking first the kingdom of God. I wish you well.